From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and I would want to repeat again. But it was pretty bad. The damage doesn't seem here as bad as what I thought, but I don't know what it's like in the other parts of the city.
Hurricane Katrina slams into Louisiana and Mississippi, leaving at least 55 people dead. 1 million people are without power. The number left homeless is unknown.
It looks like what should be a natural disaster has become a natural horror as a result of failed policies relating to coastal management and a refusal to recognize the impacts of fossil fuel-fired climate disruption, their impact on coastal citizens.
We'll talk about extreme weather, who gets hit hardest, and a stretched National Guard. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hurricane Katrina has left at least 55 people dead after slamming into Louisiana and Mississippi Monday with 145-mile-per-hour winds. The headlines in this morning's New Orleans Times-Picayune newspaper reads, "Catastrophic" and "Katrina, the storm we've always feared." The death toll is expected to rise once rescue units reach the worst-hit areas. 1 million people are without power. The number left homeless is unknown. The true extent of the damage may not be fully comprehended for days. The American Red Cross is describing Katrina as the largest recovery operation the Red Cross has ever attempted. However, the destruction could have been far worse. The storm had been on target to directly hit downtown New Orleans, but it veered to the east. Still, some 40,000 homes are underwater in New Orleans, and high winds tore off part of the roof of the Louisiana Superdome Stadium. The hardest-hit city appears to be Gulfport, Mississippi. Three of the city's five hospitals were left without emergency rooms. Eight schools that were being used as emergency shelters lost their roofs. The city's fire chief estimates 3/4 of the buildings in Gulfport have major roof damage or no roof left at all. We'll have more on the hurricane in a few minutes. The Air Force's top general said Monday U.S. warplanes will have to remain in Iraq indefinitely, even well after U.S. ground troops withdraw from the country. General John Jumper said, quote, "We'll continue with a rotational presence of some type in that area more or less indefinitely. We have interests in that part of the world and an interest in staying in touch with the militaries over there." In Iraq, a funeral was held Monday for Waleed Khaled, the sound technician working for Reuters News Agency, who was shot dead by U.S. forces Sunday. The 35-year-old Khaled was shot in the face and took at least 4 bullets to the chest. According to Reuters, U.S. soldiers were heard joking around when Waleed Khaled's family came to the scene of the shooting. As his tearful relatives inspected his corpse, a U.S. soldier said, quote, "Don't bother, it's not worth it." A few other soldiers joked among themselves just a few feet from the body. According to Reporters Without Borders, Khaled is the 66th journalist to be killed in Iraq since the March 2003 invasion. In comparison, a total of 63 journalists were killed in the entire Vietnam War. Meanwhile, Khaled's colleague, Reuters cameraman Haider Khadem, remains in U.S. detention. He was shot by an American sniper and was the only eyewitness to the killing of Khaled. Reuters is calling for his immediate release. Reuters global managing editor David Schlesinger said, quote, "We fail to understand what reason there can be for his continued detention more than a day after he was the innocent victim of an incident in which his colleague was killed." The Committee to Protect Journalists also called for Khadem's immediate release. Meanwhile, a third Iraqi journalist working for Reuters has now been held incommunicado in the Abu Ghraib prison for 3 weeks without facing charges. Also in Iraq, thousands of Sunni demonstrators rallied in Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit yesterday to denounce Iraq's proposed constitution. This news from Africa. A senior United Nations official has accused President Bush of, quote, "doing damage to Africa by cutting funding for condoms, a move which may jeopardize a successful fight against HIV/AIDS in Uganda. Stephen Lewis, the UN Secretary General Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa, says U.S. cuts in funding for condoms and an emphasis on promoting abstinence has contributed to a shortage of condoms in Uganda. Uganda has been one of the few African countries which has succeeded in reducing its HIV infection rate. The American Civil Liberties Union has obtained internal government documents that show the FBI designated two Michigan activist groups as potentially being involved, quote, in terrorist activities. One of the groups is the anti-war organization Direct Action. The second is called By Any Means Necessary. It's a national organization dedicated to defending affirmative action, integration, and other gains of the civil rights movement. ACLU staff attorney Ben Wisner said, quote, when the FBI and local law enforcement identify affirmative action advocates as potential terrorists, every American has cause for concern, he said. The ACLU has been conducting an investigation into whether the FBI has been using its joint terrorism task forces to engage in political surveillance. As part of its investigation, the ACLU has learned the FBI has collected thousands of pages of documents related to other activist groups, including Greenpeace, United for Peace and Justice, Code Pink, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and the Muslim Public Affairs Council. In Chicago, victims of police abuse are asking the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to investigate their claims that the Chicago police routinely beat and tortured African Americans to get confessions. Nearly 140 different victims have alleged abuse and torture at the hands of the Chicago police over the past few decades. Attorneys for the victims have complained that a special prosecutor has taken too long to launch a criminal prosecution into the torture claims. The attorneys are asking the International Commission to hear evidence during its October session. The commission is mandated by the Organization of American States and the American Convention on Human Rights to investigate human rights violations across the world. On Capitol Hill, three congressional Democrats have asked Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to investigate the demotion of a senior civilian Army official who publicly criticized the awarding of a no-bid contract to Halliburton for oil-related work in Iraq. In Los Angeles, a new national coalition announced plans for a national campaign to fight military recruitment of students of color in the nation's schools. Members of the coalition include Latinos for Peace and the Coalition Against Militarism in Our Schools. The groups made the announcement at Salazar Park on the 35th anniversary of the Chicano Moratorium, a protest against the disproportionate number of Latinos being killed in the Vietnam War. Salazar Park is named after journalist Ruben Salazar, who was shot dead by police after covering the moratorium march. The coalition is calling on students to sign forms that would block the military from receiving personal information about them, as well as not to take the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Test. In El Paso, Texas, a U.S. judge has begun hearing the case of Luis Posada Carriles, the Cuban exile who's wanted in Venezuela for the 1976 bombing of the Cuban airliner that killed 73 people. Posada recently snuck into the United States and is now seeking asylum. On Monday, he faced the first day of his deportation hearing. Posada is a CIA-trained operative who's been connected to several attacks on Fidel Castro and other Cuban interests. The chief of the Organization of American States, Jose Miguel Insulza, said Monday that the U.S. should extradite Posada if there's evidence of links to the 1976 bombing. Meanwhile, the presiding judge warned Posada he would seek deportation to Venezuela if he had entered the United States illegally.
Sister, he's done do like I have done.
Leadbelly, New Orleans, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country, on Pacifica NPR and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 9410, Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are podcasting at democracynow.org. Well, Hurricane Katrina slammed into the Gulf Coast with devastating force Monday morning, leaving at least 55 people dead, more than a million in three states without power. The death toll is expected to rise once rescue units reach the worst hit areas. The number left homeless unknown. The true extent of the damage may not be known for days. With 145 mile per hour winds, the storm ranks as one of the most punishing hurricanes ever to hit the United States. Insurance experts said damage could exceed $9 billion, which would make it one of the costliest storms on record. The storm had been on target to directly hit downtown New Orleans, but it veered to the east. Still, some 40,000 homes are underwater in New Orleans, and high winds tore off part of the roof of the Louisiana Superdome Stadium, where some 10,000 people were. The hardest hit area appears to be Mississippi's Harrison County, which accounts for 50 of the known deaths. In Gulfport, three of the city's five hospitals were left without emergency rooms. The city's fire chief estimates three quarters of the buildings in Gulfport have major roof damage or no roof left at all. President Bush Monday approved major disaster declarations for Louisiana and Mississippi to help them obtain government aid.
I urge the citizens there in the region to continue to listen to the local authorities. Don't abandon your shelters until you're given clearance by the local authorities. Take precautions because this is a dangerous storm. When the storm passes, the federal government has got assets and resources that will be deploying to help you. In the meantime, American will pray. Pray for the health and safety of all our citizens.
But while President Bush pledges support for the relief efforts, some say his record is not consistent. In June, the publication New Orleans City Business reported President Bush was seeking to slash funds that would help New Orleans prepare for a major hurricane. The report said that in fiscal year 2006, the New Orleans District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers faces a record $71 million reduction in federal funding. Those cuts would affect major hurricane and flood protection projects. Katrina was making its second touchdown in the U.S. after striking southern Florida last week, where it caused widespread flooding and seven deaths. We're joined on the phone by David Helvar, president of the Blue Frontier Campaign, author of the books War Against the Greens and Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas. He's also a contributor to Feeling the Heat, reports from the front lines of climate change. He joins us on the line from Hawaii. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about this devastating hurricane that has really struck hardest Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama?
Yeah, it looks like a natural disaster that has a lot of unnatural features that have made it much worse. When I went to bed last night, there was reports that the levees had given on Lake Pontchartrain. If that's true, then the disaster, the worst-case scenario New Orleans thought it had avoided, may in fact be happening now, which would put the city underwater. The lake's above the city, and the city, of course, is below sea level. Last report I heard, 80% of the city was now flooded. So the reality is while New Orleans has been at risk, some risk, since 1718, since its founding, that risk has accelerated in recent years due to subsidence land loss. Southern Louisiana, the bayous have been losing 35 to 40 square miles a year for the last several decades. This is both the result of misguided flood control efforts by the Army Corps of Engineers and the government, that canal building by the oil industry throughout the bayou. When you fly over it, as I've done, you see just a patchwork network of canals have been built to access oil industry infrastructure. That, in combination with the flood control, basically flooding historically has also brought all these sediments down the Mississippi, which have built up the bayou, built up the Deltic region. And once you put in these straight lines, they become like speedways. All that sediment and soil that used to build a delta is just flushed down into the deep oceans of the Gulf, along with a lot of pollutants. And the result is we've been seeing this tremendous rate of land loss. Historically, that wetland acts as a not only as a filter for pollution, but also as a storm barrier. Every few miles of bayou would absorb a foot of sea surge during storms like this. But, you know, where just a couple of decades ago there was 140 to 200 miles of bayou between New Orleans and the sea, it's now down to 30 miles in some areas. So when you have a major storm like Katrina, all this water comes in, you have tremendous impacts. You lost that protection, the same in areas hard hit like Biloxi, Mississippi, which used to have a lot of salt marsh. That's coastal sprawl took that out and replaced it with floating casinos, which just don't act as that good a barrier. You know, you have this terrible scenario. I don't know, Port Fouché, I think, will probably be closed for a while, which brings in 10% of the oil into this country. I was down there 2 years ago, and a spokesman for Shell Oil was complaining that the flooding and the storms were making it difficult to bring in the oil. They were thinking that maybe coastal Louisiana was no longer a friendly place for them to do business, which in my mind is kind of like the Archdiocese of Boston complaining that kids aren't as trusting anymore. Clearly a lot of this disaster is a result of the offshore industry and the product it produces.
Talking about living in the shadow of oil development, in addition to David Helvorg, president of the Blue Frontier Campaign and author of the book Blue Frontier, we're joined by Damu Smith, founder of Black Voices for Peace and executive director of the National Black Environmental Justice Network. For more than three decades, Damu has worked on environmental justice issues and lived in Louisiana for a decade. He joins us in Washington. Welcome, Damu.
Thank you so much, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. As you look at the area you lived in for a decade, your thoughts about who's being hardest hit right now and the significance of this devastating hurricane?
Well, Amy, we have to remember the demographics, the economic demographics of the states hardest hit, Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama. These three states are among the poorest states in the United States, ranking at the bottom in terms of poverty and people who are economically disadvantaged. And among those who are most economically disadvantaged are people of color, specifically African Americans. And in the case of New Orleans and Louisiana and those southern cities along the coast of Mississippi, you're talking about people who, prior to this disaster, were already economically marginalized on the fringes of society. And so if you look at the images that we see on television, those who were lined up at the Superdome going to the place of last resort, I've been watching the news all into the evening. It's mostly black people and poor people who are concentrated in the areas hardest hit. So those who were paid the most in the long term or those who, prior to this disaster, were already hardest hit by the economic injustices that they are already experiencing. New Orleans is a city of many, many, many poor people. And many of those people, along with everybody else, have lost their homes. Amy, I don't know how many of our listeners have been watching the news, but this is an absolutely devastating, catastrophic disaster that has taken place in New Orleans, in Louisiana, in Mississippi, and Alabama, and it's going to take weeks, months, if not years, for the people in these communities to recover from what has occurred.
We're talking to Damu Smith, founder of Black Voices for Peace, also David Helvorg, who is author of the book Blue Frontier. Robert Schimek will join us after break as well. He is with the Indigenous Environmental Network to talk about the Mississippi. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
There's a hot time in old town, downtown tonight. Hot times in old town tonight. It's hot times in old
time in old town tonight. Hot times in old town tonight.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the music, Mississippi John Hurt, Hard Times in the Old Town Tonight. Well, we're talking about the devastating Hurricane Katrina that has hit very hard four states, and we are focusing on New Orleans right now, but also looking at Mississippi and Alabama. We are joined by Damu Smith, who is the head of Black Voices for Peace. We're also joined by Robert Shimmick, Special Projects Coordinator of Indigenous Environmental Network, and David Helvarg. He's author of the book Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas. David Helvarg, you talk about the big bowl, New Orleans, causing a witch's brew. What do you mean?
Well, just the toxics, as was just being said, between just Baton Rouge and New Orleans, there's some 36 petrochemical complexes. A lot of these pollutants, it's historically been known as Cancer Alley, and as stated, a lot more people have been impacted. These waters, as well as all the household toxics and pollutants, as well as the cemeteries, a lot of which are above ground in New Orleans, will all be in the waters that are flooding this region. It's in that sense, a witch's brew. It's a very toxic environment that's being generated, just as happened when you had the flooding in North Carolina that went through the hog industry there. Here, it's the petrochemical industry that puts people's health at risk. And the risks are expanding exponentially. You know, it's not just poor people in the brunt of the globally introduced climate change. All of that.
David, you're breaking up a bit. So if you could stay wherever you were, because we were hearing you fine until just a second ago.
I was just saying that globally the impacts of climate change are also being felt disproportionately by the poor people of the world, from island states like the Marshall Islands to Bangladesh to subtropical Africa, where you're going to see the agricultural impacts have the greatest impact. Last year, we had a $42 billion hurricane season. This year is on track to be perhaps even more devastating, certainly in terms of human life, potentially in terms of cost to the nation, financial cost. And it's not just that we're in a 25-year cycle of intensified Atlantic hurricanes. It's that we're in the footprint of climate change. Every scientist and climatologist I talk to says that clearly, if not in 1988, then certainly in 1997 and 98, we saw more rainforest burn than in any time in history. At the same time, global coral bleaching as a global event. We're seeing these impacts and not responding to them. We'll see in terms of dealing with environmental refugees, dealing with the impacts on the poor, or dealing with the impacts on our increasingly populated coast, where we're still promoting policies that drive people in harm's way.
Robert Shimmick, can you take us down the Mississippi? Talk about what's in it and what it means to have this kind of hurricane at the base.
Thank you, Amy. And yes, I'm up here on the opposite end of the river, in the headwaters region of the Mississippi here in northern Minnesota. I cross the Mississippi several times on my way to work each day. And, you know, over the years have just gotten intimately familiar with the character of the river here before it leaves this region. And I must say that, you know, what I'm hearing being described here on the air this morning, it's, you know, up here where we're at, it's, you know, the river is of an entirely different character. You know, it's a very soft and a very gentle and a very beautiful and inspiring river, as before it leaves the state here. Now, I also want to say that, to the indigenous people of the region here, the Headwaters is a very special place. It is a sacred place. It is a place that, in our past and even, by some now is regarded, in a very special way, as in, how we go there, how we approach it when we go to places like Lake Itasca, where the river's origins began. And I would also say that, aside from the mercury pollution, which we all have here in northern Minnesota, as well as other places throughout the country, that has affected the water quality in our lakes. Aside from that, the Mississippi is very clean here. As it comes through the, there's fish consumption advisories in pretty much all of the lakes here, statewide in Minnesota. But as the river leaves here, of course we have those fish consumption advisories related to mercury, but we get our first consumption advisory related to dioxin at the community of Grand Rapids, which is probably, I'm going to say it's less, it's less than the first 100 miles of the river from its headwaters, and that increasingly as it works its way toward the Gulf, there's this added burden of chemicals that cause it to, by the time it leaves Minnesota here, many of the species of fish in the lower Mississippi here in Minnesota are not fit to eat. And I encourage anybody, if you want to have a good history or a good chronology or a good documentation in terms of what happens to our river after it leaves here, look at the Mississippi River Fish Consumption Advisory, and of course it's increasingly worse as it works its way downstream. Now, why is that? Clearly we have some of the same issues here in Minnesota, with the industrialization of the river, using it as a sewer dump for industry, and that, many of the dioxins and PCBs and, various heavy metals, Minnesota is a contributor.
Robert Chimick, as you make your way down to Louisiana, talk about the changes and what you think this is going to mean with the level of water right now that is inundating Louisiana.
Well, I think that, one of the things that we learned in the flood of 1993 was that, the role of wetlands along the river and its tributaries. There was, some of you may remember, in June of 1993, there was major flooding from the headwaters on down to, about St. Louis, mid-river, lower river. And in the aftermath of that, the Corps of Engineers and others undertook a study to try and understand what happened. And from that study, realized that we had eliminated in excess of 80% of the wetlands along the banks of the Mississippi and her major tributaries, and begin to better understand the role of these wetlands in terms of filtering out agricultural runoff. When we talk about the way the river is here and the huge dead zone off the Mississippi Delta, or what's left of the Mississippi Delta, agriculture is, of course, a huge contributor. Agricultural runoff, as in feedlot runoff from cattle, pesticides and fertilizer, all draining into the river and contributing to the toxic load and, you know, the various other industries. I think that here in the northern reaches of the river, you know, it's...
Well, let me bring David Helvarg in to talk about this dead zone.
Yeah, the as he was explaining, the agricultural runoff, the Mississippi drains 40% of America's landmass, 50% of its agriculture, and because we've gone to petrochemical farming and industrial farming of corn, and in places like Iowa, you put 140 pounds of fertilizer per acre. All that nutrient waste runs down the Mississippi and creates a second crop of algae in the Gulf of Mexico. The copepod small critters and microbes feed on that, and in the process of feeding, they take the dissolved oxygen out of the water. Everything that can't flee dies. And interestingly, this summer, with the warm water and the pollution, you had the largest dead zone to date, over 8,000 square miles. The hurricane may have brought oxygen back into the water, but it's not the way to fix the problem. And one of the tragedies, and hopefully one of the lessons, is there are solutions. There are efforts. We can do a wetlands restoration. We can move away from industrial farming to organic and healthful modes that don't create this nutrient load that impact our oceans. We can do planned retreat from coastal areas. There's a study, a government study, says one out of four buildings within 500 feet of the oceans will be destroyed in the next 50 years. That's a period when we should be doing planned retreat. We should be restoring the protective wetlands that are also the nurseries of the ocean and of the diversity of life we want to share on this planet. And as I say, the solutions are there. There are these, you know, special interests. We know that necessity drives innovation, and we know now that we can't continue to function and use the Gulf of Mexico and Louisiana as a place to generate fossil fuel that we burn, that then intensifies the hurricanes that help undermine our coastal communities and way of life. And so, you know, we need new policies, and we need a new approach. We just put out a new book called The Ocean and Coastal Conservation Guide. We identified some 2,000 organizations just in the United States that are working to do what I call seaweed marine grassroots, bottom-up. The solutions are there. We know how we can avoid natural disasters, but the unnatural consequences. We know that we can do things in a better way, but there are all these special interests that have to be confronted in order to do the right thing.
Damu Smith, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation. I met you some, I don't know, 15 years ago, I think it was, in Baton Rouge at an environmental justice conference. Now, it may be that a lot of people don't even know that term, environmental justice or environmental racism. Can you talk about it and then apply it to what we're seeing today?
Well, between Baton Rouge, which is north of Louisiana, north of New Orleans, and New Orleans itself, there are scores of polluting facilities lining the Mississippi River on both sides of the river. You're talking about numerous petrochemical plants, plastic production facilities, and other heavy industries that are contributing to the pollution flowing into the Mississippi River. Now, near these facilities, in the shadow of these plants, are scores of African-American communities, mostly African-American impoverished communities. People, black and white and Latino, who live in these areas are exposed to a toxic soup of chemicals regularly released into the air, into the soil, into the water. Now, one of the things I want to add to this discussion, Amy, is that within New Orleans itself, there are a number of Superfund toxic sites in neighborhoods. The Agricultural Street Landfill Superfund site has been one of the most controversial sites in the city of New Orleans. We have been working with Elodia Blanco and her group, Concerned Citizens of Ag Street. In fact, I spoke to Ms. Blanco as she was hurriedly trying to get her invalid father and her daughter out of the house on Sunday in preparation for the hit by the storm. It's impossible to reach any of them now because of the phone services are down. But I'm just imagining the water. If the water is flooding her neighborhood, and I'm imagining that it is, all of those toxic chemicals below their homes have come up, and the water that we see in the footage coming through the new television footage contains all of these toxic chemicals. So we're not just talking about fireflies and ants that we're hearing in the major media. We're talking about serious chemicals that are a threat to human health. And now all of this is in the water, being washed into people's homes, and it's contaminating the water. St. Charles Parish, just north of New Orleans, has the Shell Norco chemical plant and numerous other polluting facilities. It's not clear what's happening in that parish, but I would imagine that St. Charles Parish has also been hit. East New Orleans has been a hard hit. I've been to East New Orleans. There are a number of toxic sites in that area right near poor and African-American communities. So this is a disaster, not only in terms of the flooding that's going on, the long-term economic consequences, but it is also an environmental disaster. One more thing I'd like to add, Amy, is that this issue of climate change is very, very serious, as our other guest has stated. The Gulf waters have been very warm, and the warming of the waters contributes to the power and the force of these hurricanes. So while we know hurricanes are indeed a natural disaster, man-made industrial processes are contributing to the enhancement of the power and destruction of hurricanes because of global warming. So this is a critical issue that we have to face as we move into this century, but we'd also have to face the fact that the infrastructure deficit in New Orleans has also contributed to this disaster. I believe that we're not just talking about poor planning, we're not just talking about the issues of planning, but we're talking about issues of investment in the infrastructure necessities that are needed to protect the people of New Orleans from this kind of disaster, and that obviously did not occur.
Damu, the last time we had you on, we were talking about your own battle right now, your battle against fourth-stage colon cancer, and I'm wondering how you're doing. We also talked about the issue of health and racism within the medical system.
Well, Amy, I'm feeling fine. I'm still battling stage four colon cancer and liver cancer. And thanks to all of the prayers and support of many, many people, my tumors have reduced significantly. I'm still battling. I'm fighting the good fight. And I'm just happy to be here live this morning to be on this program. And thanks for keeping me in mind when you have these topics to discuss.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I want to thank Damu Smith for being there and today on this show, founder of Black Voices for Peace. Look forward to having you on again soon on these and other issues. David Helvarg, thank you for joining us. Final comments as you watch this storm from your vantage point in Hawaii.
Well, flying back here, it was interesting from a distance. The coverage as the storm swamped Louisiana was obviously less intense here. People are isolated, and yet so many of the same issues wherever you go. I mean, people are at war here over coastal development and loss of traditional people's access to the shoreline, and there's concerns over energy and how to move off their dependence on fossil fuels and the sense of being an island which is dependent at risk. We're all on an island, and it's a planetary island, and we're putting at a tremendous risk. We aren't actually very specific and identifiable special interests are. And I think, you know, we, the people, have to organize to be able to live with the natural world and deal with its consequences in more sensible and productive ways. And in the next months, it's just a question of paying attention, I think, after, pay attention to what the EPA tells us and what's really happening in those waters and with the kind of support that the victims of this receive and the relative support of well-to-do beach homeowners versus poorer communities that are impacted. It's an ongoing struggle, and hopefully we learn some lessons from disasters like this and just don't let them keep repeating themselves.
David Helvar, president of the Blue Frontier Campaign, his book, Blue Frontier. And Robert Shimek, thanks so much for being with us. Special Projects Coordinator of the Indigenous Environmental Network, the other end of the Mississippi at the headwaters. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we will talk briefly about the National Guard, how it has been stretched in Louisiana, and then Juan Cole. Juan Cole talking about the situation in the Middle East. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, Otha Turner, Glory, Glory, Hallelujah, democracynow.org. We're podcasting at democracynow.org as well. I'm Amy Goodman. With search and rescue operations underway in multiple states, many communities facing massive reconstruction efforts. State governments are relying significantly on aid from the National Guard. But with the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, the number of Guard's people available at home has been slashed. Some 6,000 National Guard in Louisiana and Mississippi who would be available to help deal with the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina are in Iraq. Nationally, 78,000 of 437,000 members of the Guard force are deployed overseas. Still, the National Guard insists it has enough troops to address the storm, but officials from several states have said it's not the case. Earlier this month, the Louisiana National Guard publicly complained that too much of its equipment was in Iraq. The local ABC News affiliate reported dozens of high-water vehicles, Humvees, refuelers, and generators are now abroad. Other states are facing shortfalls as well when facing fires, floods, or other disasters. A few months before summer began, Montana's governor called for that state's National Guard to be brought home from Iraq because of possible wildfires. As is the case with Louisiana's Guard, Montana found that critical equipment was overseas in Iraq. This included the bulk of the Guard's helicopters, which are critical in shuttling fire crews and equipment to blazes. We're joined now by Rosemary Brash. She's worked with the Red Cross as a family services specialist for national disasters. She worked on several hurricanes along the East Coast and has written on the issue with her husband, Walter Brash. Their piece is called An Ill Wind and American Policy. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. Very briefly, can you comment on this stretched National Guard?
Actually, we were just talking about that yesterday as I heard a blurb or saw a blurb on CNN about the National Guard coming into the area of the hurricane. And I said, possibly it will be a plus for that area because to avoid criticism, they may be very quick to get as many National Guard as possible there from further away, from other areas. But to have the National Guard presence be seen, I've been in areas, and I know the importance of having them there for psychological reasons, for comfort, for safety, for all those different things. And in getting them there, I was thinking about this, and if Louisiana is saying that too many of their National Guard are away, they really are very fortunate because they would have something to compare it to. Because I was in New Orleans for, I believe, it was a flood several years ago. They really have a recent history. When you look, you see, oh, the National Guard's going, we don't have too many over there. We have plenty. We haven't spread them too thin. Look, they're there already. That may be fine if In fact, they send as many as are needed. What I think they will do is send in an amount of them to say the National Guard is there. But as you were saying from the article previously, you get all the water buffalo that are needed there, the trucks, the half tracks, all those kind of things that, judging from the size of this, will be needed for a long time. And many of them, because it's a very widespread area, that's when I think you will start to see more more of less. How's that? There will be some there. There will be some equipment and some people, and certainly the National Guard that they send from wherever they pull them will do their very best with the equipment they have. What would be interesting is to see a comparison study of past disasters of that size, where the National Guard came from, how well-versed they were with the area, what equipment was available, and I think you will find that it's like they sent a skeleton crew. It's there, but it's not as much as should be there. And there's also no guarantee there won't be another need for them somewhere else. I think I said yesterday I thought George Bush was very fortunate to have got on America's side because he stopped this from being totally catastrophic, or we would be in even worse shape. Those people would be. We fortunately are not. But the people in that area of the country affected by it would be in worse shape. I also recall during, I think, one of a threat from a disease of a hurricane last year, this year, sometime, one of the major problems was lack of plywood. The plywood has gone to Iraq to rebuild Iraq. And when people desperately needed it to board up homes and shops and so on here, it was in much shorter supply. I don't know if they ran into that in Louisiana and Mississippi and those areas. But those are things not National Guard, but most definitely affected by having all the action over in Iraq.
Rosemary Brash, I want to thank you for being with us. Worked as a Red Cross Family Services Specialist for national disasters and has written with her husband, Walter Brash, An Ill Wind, An American Policy, a piece on natural disasters and the National Guard. I was just thinking about people like Celeste Zapala, who, together with Cindy Sheehan, founded Gold Star Mothers for Peace. Her son, Sherwood Baker, in Pennsylvania, the first to die in the Pennsylvania National Guard since 1945, since World War II. She said he joined the National Guard precisely for situations like these, not to go to Iraq, as he did and died. Well, on August 5th, Cindy Sheehan announced at the Veterans for Peace annual convention that she would begin a vigil in Crawford, Texas, on the next day that would last until President Bush met with her. Although President Bush has, until this point, refused to meet with her, her vigil goes on and continues to reinvigorate the movement around the country. On that same day, August 5th, that Cindy Sheehan made that announcement, Vice President Dick Cheney was nearly 8,000 miles away in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. He was leading an American delegation to meet the newly installed King Abdullah and to pay condolences on the death of his half-brother, King Fahd. The delegation also included former President Bush and former Secretary of State Colin Powell. Cheney's meeting with Abdullah came just months after the Saudi leader visited President Bush at his estate in Crawford. That visit made international headlines when Bush held hands with Abdullah as they walked by the blue bonnets on his estate. Well, to speak about U.S.-Saudi relations, we return to part two of our conversation with Professor Juan Cole. Juan Cole is professor of history at University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and he runs a blog called Informed Comment, which can be found at juancole.com. He joined us last week from a TV studio at the University of Michigan campus, and I asked him to talk about the significance of Vice President Cheney and former President Bush's meeting with the Saudi King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz.
Well, we don't know what was discussed, but we do know that there are a number of very important issues facing the United States and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's population, as opposed to its government, has been relatively favorable towards the radical Muslim movements. Many have run off to fight in Iraq against the Americans among the Saudis. And there have been substantial numbers of terrorist actions inside Saudi Arabia itself, in Riyadh, against the U.S. Embassy in Jeddah, against foreign workers at oil facilities. The Saudi government initially was slow on the uptake, did not perceive the danger to the kingdom itself in these. I think now it is increasingly effective in cracking down and is becoming an effective partner in fighting the spread of this radical extremist right-wing terrorism. And I'm sure that those issues were at the forefront of the Bush and Cheney consultations with Fahd. But it should also be remembered that the price of petroleum is now in the $63 a barrel and more and less in that range. Since Saudi Arabia produces something on the order of 9 million barrels a day, it is and is the largest, by far, the largest exporter of petroleum in the world. Enormous amounts of U.S. capital are going into the Gulf, and the way that this has been arranged in the past so as to not bankrupt the U.S. economy has been to ensure that the Saudis recycle the funds into U.S. investments. And there have been problems about getting the Saudis to do that in recent years. A lot of them are angry about the punitive U.S. Attitudes towards Saudi Arabia in the wake of 9/11, with which the Saudi government was not involved. But certainly Osama bin Laden is a Saudi, and some of the opprobrium fell on the government in Riyadh. And so there have been Saudi investors who have been pulling their investments from the United States, putting them in Europe and elsewhere. Sure, that the Bush and Cheney were pressing the new King Abdullah to keep that sweet deal going, whereby they sell us petroleum and then they take the money that we give them and reinvest it in the United States.
Professor Cole, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, the new Saudi ambassador to the United States in Washington, replacing what many have called Bandar Bush, or certainly what the Bush family have affectionately called him, and his relationship with Osama bin Laden. Can you talk about that?
Well, former U.S. National Security or terrorism czar Richard Clark alleged in his book that Turki Al-Faisal recruited Osama bin Laden for fundraising in the Gulf private sector for the Mujahideen or the fighters against the Soviet occupation in Afghanistan. Certainly Turki Al-Faisal has had a number of meetings with Osama in the 80s and the last, I believe it was 1997 in Kandahar in Afghanistan, when, as we understand it, he went there to attempt to convince the Taliban to extradite bin Laden. By then he had broken with him. But there was a relationship earlier on, apparently, between Saudi intelligence and the Arab Afghans, the volunteers like bin Laden that went to work for the resistance against the Soviets in Peshawar in Pakistan. That's a troubled history, and I think it makes the new ambassador's job very difficult to come into the United States with that kind of history. Of course, it is a history that is shared with many Reagan administration figures who also supported the radical Muslims against the Soviets back in the 1980s. But I think the important thing is that clearly King Abdullah has confidence in Turki Al-Faisal. He is the son of an assassinated former king, and therefore a prince in his own right, and feels that he has the weight and the experience to deal with Washington. And so I think there are some troubling aspects of this appointment, but in diplomacy, access is everything. So if Turki Al-Faisal comes in and he has good access to King Abdullah, he has good access to Bush, then that will grease the wheels of the relationship. And while that relationship is problematic in many ways, it should be noted that Abdullah, when he was crown prince, was really running things for the last few years, on foreign policy actually has taken some good steps and is much better than Fahad in that regard. He opposed the Iraq War. He thought it would be a disaster. He was right. He put forward a comprehensive plan for peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors, which he got adopted by the Arab League. It did call on Israel to go back to 1967 borders and give up the occupied territories, and was rejected by the Sharon government out of hand. But here you have a king of Saudi Arabia who is adopting positions on foreign policy in some regards that I think would be welcomed by many on the American left. So that part of the relationship could be positive.
Wasn't Prince Turki Al-Faisal also named in the 9/11 lawsuit of family members of those who died? And didn't Baker Botts, of course, the law firm of James Baker, aren't they representing not the 9/11 family members, but the Saudi regime?
Sure. Well, there were allegations of Saudi officials being involved in 9/11. In my view, they're baseless. The Saudi elite has enormous amounts of money, as I said, invested in the New York stock market. And the last thing they would want is to see the value of their portfolios badly damaged. So just even if, you know, one set aside their human feelings about civilians being killed, which they have, it makes no sense that someone high in the Saudi government would be involved in that. That was a terrorist action. It was by a radical fringe. I mean, there may have been low-level Saudi government officials who supported bin Laden without knowing what he was planning to do. But I simply do not believe that the Saudi government or high Saudi officials and princes had foreknowledge of this event or were in any way involved in it. And
Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan, runs a blog called Informed Comment. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. We'll also link to the first part of this interview. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shufo Dokadoos, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, Nell Geiser, Susie Salami. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Uri Gallad, Angela Alston. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.